It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Smart cooking, it requires the right tools for the job. And our new food series here takes us deeper into the tools we use in the kitchen and how to get the most out of these gadgets. And first up, if we're cooking, we're likely wielding a knife. Call in with all your questions and experiences with kitchen knives. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Josh Donald owns a sharpening business and knife shop in San Francisco called Bernal Cutlery. Josh, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Take us on a tour first of your personal knives in your kitchen. What can you tell us about them? What do you see?
Well, I've got a mix of knives that belong to me personally and some knives from the shop that are coming home to get tested out, new knives that we're considering carrying. Whenever we add a line to our shop, we'll, kind of put it through the paces in a bunch of the kitchens of our crew, and usually starting with me and my wife's kitchen. And so I've got a mix of Japanese knives. There's some little small factory-made Japanese knives. There's some really wonderful handmade ones. I've got some old carbon steel sabatiers, and there's a knife from Sheffield, England, that is in the paces right now.
So basically, you've got a collection. Which you would think you would owning a knife shop. Can you tell us some of the distinct differences between, you mentioned, Japanese knives and, say, European knives?
Sure. So the biggest difference is going to be that the Japanese are coming from the perspective of having a knife for a specific job. And while specific use knives in the Western knife catalog definitely exist, something like a chef's knife, which is really like the daily driver for a lot of people, by its definition, that that knife is a multi-purpose tool. And then the Western approach to it, it's made a bit softer and tougher to handle a wider variety of tasks. And the Japanese version of that Western tool, that the chef's knife, or gyuto, would be harder, higher carbon content steel. It'd have a little bit narrower range of application, but it's going to typically hold its edge a bit longer and in many instances have a little more finesse with fine work. But the Western knives are still capable of a lot of finesse.
When you say a narrower range of application, what do you mean by that?
Well, like splitting a hard winter squash or quartering a chicken, something where the knife is going to encounter harder ingredients, a harder, higher carbon content steel can potentially chip with that kind of use. So the trade-off for that longer-lived edge, the finer edge that that a Japanese knife can take, is a bit more of a brittle edge that can get damaged.
So, you know, I tense my shoulders up to my ears and I'm chop, 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 chop as fast as I can when I use like a chef's knife. Does our motion with a knife matter when you're choosing a knife, whether you do the rocking motion thing or that staccato chop, chop, chop thing?
Yeah. So, if the knife is going to pivot at all and exert lateral pressure on the sides of the blades, go with something softer. So if you hold the blade down, so if you're going to mince a clove of garlic and you hold the tip end of the knife down and you chop in the heel, that twisting motion that's underneath your palm, that's on the spine of the blade, as the knife kind of, twists on the board, that can damage a Japanese knife. So they don't want to be used like that typically. That lateral pressure, it could be said that that's not the best way to use it, but a softer Western knife isn't really going to complain. Yeah.
But that's how you get out just all the aggressions of the day or something, just chopping as fast as you can.
I mean, it cooking is a wonderful thing, and it is a great way to kind of center yourself in the moment. And
you're so diplomatic.
hopefully it doesn't involve, you know, enough force to center you in another moment in the ER. So ease off the gas. It's okay.
Josh Donald with us owns a knife sharpening business and knife shop in San Francisco. Wrote the book Sharp, by the way. You can join in all your questions on kitchen knives as part of our new food series. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Josh, toss out some brands, if you will. When we're looking at different brands, whether it's Japanese or European knife makers, is there something we should look for or watch out for? Because there's a lot out there to choose from.
Yeah. There's definitely, there's the big makers, and those would be ones that you would more easily find in a lot of housewares places. And while some knife connoisseurs might look down their nose at some of those brands, not all of their products are bad. Mostly if you're buying knives, the people, at the shop that you're buying them from should be able to compare them to each other and kind of let you know the differences in terms of what to expect by way of the sharpening needs, what to expect for edge life, and how to compare the toughnesses of the different ones. If you get a little bit of a sales pitch about like the legend of the samurai and things that aren't as specific to the individual knives, then maybe hold off and make sure that you're buying from somebody that can actually give you like really useful information. There's tons of great knives out there. It's very subjective in a way. There definitely is, plenty of, malarkey, but at the same time, the best is a very subjective kind of idea. 'Cause for one person, the best is going to be something that's really tough, isn't going to complain about getting twisted chopping garlic, and for another person that knife would feel maybe clumsy and not and kind of a little clubby, and so something with a lot more finesse would be the way to go. But for the person that is a little harder on their knives, needs something that's going to be a little more forgiving, that real finesse oriented knife might kind of get damaged quickly and feel too light possibly. So
Speaking of being forgiving, I mean, my coworker said that she'll spend no time maintaining a knife. And so if you're that kind of person, and I kind of fall in that category as well, what types of knives should you have on hand if you're not into like really maintain, a high maintenance thing of sharpening and staying on top of them? What can stand up to just like the day to day of just let's have a great knife all the time?
In a way it's kind of like combing your hair or brushing your hair. If you never wanted to deal with it, I suppose you could shave your head. And being bald myself, that's my solution. So nothing's going to stay sharp all the time. And if you've heard the sales pitch, never needs sharpening, that is just a, unless you don't use it, then it doesn't need sharpening. But everything goes dull. Everything gets used in, So there's things that are easier to look out for. So like stainless steel, you could prep, cook, eat, hang out, and then go clean your knife later. That might not be the best, hygiene-oriented thing if you've been, cutting something that really should get washed after you use it. But a stainless steel knife won't complain about that treatment. A non-stainless steel carbon steel knife would be rusty when you came back to it. But if you were looking for a knife that was easy to keep an edge on, 50 years ago, Julia Childs would have told you to get a carbon steel knife that is a non-stainless steel, because it held its edge longer and sharpened easier. And so if the edge itself is more of the primary concern, and if you're not averse to using a honing rod every now and then, you know, and if you could look after cast iron pans and you're, you know, a little bit detail oriented in terms you know, being able to, you know, then I encourage people to experiment with carbon steel, the old tried and true non-stainless material. You know, a lot of people have an experience of, you know, having an old knife that is in their kitchen. Maybe they inherited it from their family, and it just seems to hold an edge forever, where the stainless knives kind of feel a little bit slippery or, you know, not as lively as that carbon one.
Josh Donald owns a knife shop, is our resource on how to handle kitchen knives, the ones that should be our go-to in cooking. Call in with your questions about the knives in your kitchen, sharpening, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What do you look for in a good kitchen knife? As part of our new food series, we find out how to ensure our knives make cooking easier and that they complement other kitchen tools. Call in with the questions you want to explore about kitchen cutlery, 800-642-1234. Josh Donald is here, owns a knife shop in San Francisco, and stays with us. So, Josh, let's get to it on sharpening. How should home chefs sharpen their knives?
Well, first thing is to avoid the pull-through sharpeners that use carbide scraper blades. Those will 100% ruin your knife, so avoid those. But a honing steel for when the knife is starting to lose its sparkle is a great way to put a fresh edge on there. I like to set the steel or ceramic rod straight up and down on a work surface and set the blade at about the same angle as a book of matches and gently roll that edge down the side of the sharpening rod or steel and then feel outward. You should feel a smooth edge as you feel outward on the blade. You're looking for the little bend. About 90% of knives start to dull by the edge bending a little bit. And Japanese whetstones are my preferred method for sharpening. It takes a bit of technique to, you know, and it's not necessarily an intuitive process. We do classes in the shop in Bernal Cutlery. You know, those are little classes, just maximum six people. In the shop. We've also put up a bunch of videos on our YouTube channel. And you
so
know,
a bit of technique there to do. Yes. So Grant emailed to ask, can a high-quality stainless steel serrated bread knife be successfully sharpened? Would the scallop side of the knife be sharpened as well as the flat side?
So typically at home, if you don't have a machine to regrind those serrations, as I don't think a lot of people have laying around, if you find something that fits the diameter of those serrations, like a pen or a bigger marker for larger serrations, wrap a little bit of medium fine sandpaper over that and drag it through those serrations, and then run it through a cork to take off some of the roughness left on the edge. That's a kind of needs must style, but that will make the knife a bit livelier.
Oh, interesting. When you say sandpaper, though, is there a specific type, fine, coarse, medium?
Maybe like 320. It kind of depends how dull the edge is. And there's a limit to how much you can use this technique on a really, really damaged and beat up knife. You know, a lot of times that will get a livelier edge on your serrated knife.
When is it a good idea or a good time for you to take a knife to be professionally sharpened?
when you can't get a good edge back on your own. And keep in mind, a professional is only professional because they take money for it. So maybe, you know, if you're trying out a new sharpener, bring them one knife and see how they do with it. Typically, services that are very, very convenient and very, very inexpensive will have a trade-off. So if a sharpener is, you know, handling a huge line of people and, you know, you get, like, get your knives back in 15 minutes, they might be kind of going at it a little bit too aggressively. So sometimes they're skilled and they can pull it off, but a lot of times that type of sharpening where it's done in a few minutes, you know, can just take off too much metal from the edge. So make sure that they haven't really ground your knife down a ton by using really excessively aggressive machines. That said, it is necessary to use aggressive grinding to remove, you know, enough metal to get a fresh edge and a good geometry on a knife. So the presence of a grinder isn't a bad sign per se.
Josh Donald, I'm going to just reintroduce you here for a moment. We're talking about how to sharpen and maintain kitchen knives with Josh Donald, owns a knife sharpening business, a knife shop in San Francisco. You can call in with your questions about kitchen knives, 800-642-1234. Shelley is here from Burlington with a question. Hi, Shelley.
Hi. I have a knife that is stamped F-Deck. And it's been in my family forever. I looked it up online, and Google says it's a decent knife. But it has a broken handle. It had the one side of the handle is broken down to the first pin. And I'm wondering if it's worth getting it fixed, if I should get it fixed, would they just replace the handle, or what I should do about that. It works fine. I've used it with the handle broken, and it, you know, it's not wobbly or anything.
Shelly, thank you. Josh, what should Shelly do?
Well, woodworkers can put on a fresh handle for you. Sometimes it's a bit hard to find someone to do that work. If the knife still has lots of life left in the blade, then that can definitely be worth it. And especially if it's, you know, come down through your family and it's got some significance in that respect, it can be worth it. You know, having a woodworker put on a handle for you typically isn't cheap. So sometimes that costs the same amount as a new knife, but sounds like this has some significance that a new knife wouldn't have. And some of those old F-Dick knives are great, great old knives. So, you know, if it still works with a little crack in the handle, then you can keep using it with the crack in the handle. If big chunks of the handle are missing, that can make it real uncomfortable, though.
Well, you know, what should you look for in the knife handle in terms of the ease of function and ergonomics?
It's a little subjective. You know, there's the old style riveted slab handle knives, and sometimes the weight and feel of those handle geometries can be just somebody's jam, and it's, you know, really comfortable. There's Japanese handles. Those can be a much lighter weight that put the weight of the knife a little bit closer to the tip. And they're, you know, something being excessively handle heavy or excessively tip heavy might not be the best choice for one person or another, but there is no, like, only one standard for a balance point in a knife. But it should feel, when you pick up the knife, it should feel comfortable in your hand. It should, like, you know, say, hey, let's get to work. It shouldn't say, like, you know, this is it shouldn't leave you kind of like reaching for something comfortable, or, you know, if it's too small and you feel like you have to squeeze it too hard, then that can be a sign that the handle is not right. If it's too big and it feels like it's just completely dominating your hand and it won't allow you a variety of grips, then maybe that's not the one for you. There's different handle, you know, hand sizes out there.
Okay.
But typically people don't find they need, you know, three different size pens in their houses to accommodate, you know, different sized hands in that way. So it may be overstating that point.
We only have a few seconds left, so this is going to be a hot take, but what about knife blocks? Thumbs up or thumbs down?
I'd have to say thumbs down because you're in terms of buying a set of knives, you're probably going to be buying one or two that aren't your ideal knife. You maybe don't need one or two of those. You know, lots of people buy a knife block with a set of knives and they never do any butchery at home, but it came with a boning knife. Sometimes the steels in those knife block sets are not the best, but using a block to store your knives in, that's a fine, fine idea. That's nothing wrong with that.
Josh, thank you for joining us.
No, thank you for having me. And, I appreciate, spending the morning with you.
Happy shopping. Josh Donald, owner of Bernal Cutlery, knife sharpening business and knife shop in San Francisco. And the kitchen is still open, as they say, as we move on to cutting boards now. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We kick off a food series on how to make the best use of the kitchen tools that fill up cupboard space and are the workhorses of meal prep. I'm looking at you, cutting boards. Call in with your questions and comments about how to choose, maintain, and use cutting boards. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Rick Odi is a wood carver, co-owns a wood kitchen products business in Sturgeon Bay. Rick, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you. I appreciate being on today.
Well, take us through how a home chef should pick the type of wood for a cutting board. What would you recommend?
Well, it's not so much the wood, and I can talk about that. It's the surface. Is it the traditional butcher block where you, if you're looking at the board and there's long strips in it, that would be called a butcher block style or edge grain. Or if you're looking at the top of or the face of the cutting board and you see the almost looks like a checkerboard, and that's called end grain. That's the end of the board. The two significant styles. One is the best, and one is adequate. When the knife passes through the wood on an edge grain board, the knife actually cuts and severs the wood fiber, and which is fine, but it shows more wear and tear. It dulls your knives quicker, and ultimately, it will show character much faster than an end grain. The end grain, your knife passes over or skates over the end grain, and it doesn't cut into the fiber. The fibers of the wood open up, they accept the knife, and then after passing through, it self-heals. Those are the two styles.
So the edge grain and the end grain, but there's also the face grain, which is the widest and longest surface of the board. What are those attributes?
Those are the same as the edge grain. You get a little bit more. You get the prettiness of the wood grain, and it acts just like the edge grain or the butcher block style, to the traditional butcher block style of the board.
What is considered an appropriate size for a cutting board?
You know, that is a good question. As far as the prep, if you're prepping every day and you're cutting vegetables, you're cutting your tomatoes and peppers and onions and things like that, there's different styles of and routines that home chefs will go through. And as far as if you like to cut and chop and you like to have separate piles, you're going to need a little bit more surface area. I do most of the cooking in our household, and I have a board that's very similar to an 18x12. Probably our most popular size that we sell is probably a 16x20, just because it allows more surface area to cut, chop, and then kind of mound up your piles. So
that's right. I can visualize it, Rick.
Yeah, absolutely. And the cool thing is that, it kind of gives you a little satisfaction because as you're then adding into your saute pan or your pan, you get to, kind of pick them up with however you scoop it and move it into the pan. So it's a process, and it's just like woodworking. As far as there's a process to making a board, there's a process to cooking, and we all love the final piece, whether it's a woodworking piece as a cutting board or the final product as a piece of wonderful dinner.
Coming from the mouth of a woodworker himself,
right? Exactly. Yep.
Well. Does the weight of a cutting board matter?
Not really. I mean, I've always joked that I could probably make an end grain board out of a very light wood like balsa wood or pine and still get the great satisfaction and the benefits of an end grain with a very soft wood versus a very hard wood. The weight does matter, but the thickness dictates the weight, and if you go real thin, if you have it on the countertop, what happens typically is that the board will slide as you're chopping and cutting. We put on all of our end grain boards, we put a rubber foot on the board, so it lifts up the board a little bit off the counter, grips the countertop so that you can really lay into it in your chopping or cutting, and the board isn't going anywhere. The other benefit for that is getting it up a little bit is that if there's water involved, the water gets up under the board, it won't it won't do anything to the board. You can easily pick it up, dry it, and for your cleaning process.
We're going to get to the cleaning in just a moment, but I want to just ask you about the different types of wood. I mean, we often see bamboo out there as an option. I like to really try to find Wisconsin, cutting boards that are made from, Wisconsin trees. Do you have any suggestions there?
Absolutely. Wisconsin is, has a wonderful, but as far as we have wonderful lumber to choose from in
yes.
terms of our trees, and it varies from the north of the state down to the south, southwest. But as far as for the last 22 years, I've been strictly using North American hardwoods. That would be the walnuts, the hard maple, cherry. We use oaks. And since moving back to Wisconsin and because of the plethora of ash trees that unfortunately have had to come down, ash is becoming one of my more favorable woods to use. So it has a lot to do with the grain of the wood, but a hardwood has a very dense structure to the cellular makeup of the wood, and it's just easy. It's easy to maintain, and as far as I've never used exotic hardwoods because of the varying levels of oils, whether they're food safe or not food safe. It's just easy to eliminate those woods, and we're very consistent about the woods that we use. But they're in our backyard; they're easily available, and that's what we choose to use.
Rick Odie, co-owner of a wood kitchen products businesses based in Door County, as we explore wooden cutting boards and the best fit for your kitchen. You can join in with your questions about cutting boards, 800-642-1234. We heard from Nessie in Oconomowoc, who is vegan and wonders if they need to regularly disinfect their cutting board if they're not cutting meat on it. What would you recommend?
Well, the interesting thing with North American hardwoods, and I'm not sure about other exotic woods, but all of our North American hardwoods have an acid and enzyme base to it that kill bacteria in the wood within just minutes of contact. And, you know, that's a natural disinfecting agent that's already existing in the wood. And that was accidentally found out by research years ago at the University of Wisconsin. So that's a natural and normal thing. The other part of it is that depending on what you're cutting and is cut, chop, and if there's juices and things like that, I just wipe it down and I go on to the next item and go from there. So it's a very safe surface to cut on. The big scare was, you know, I think comes out of the restaurant industry where the bacterial makeup and content that could arise and potentially get people sick, there's more of a chance of cross-contamination and bacteria on plastic cutting boards than there are with wood. Unfortunately, in the restaurant business, things are moving really, really fast, and cross-contamination is a huge potential problem. And the plastic poly boards can be easily bleached and chemically cleaned really fast, and that's why they do what they do. Mm. But in the home, it's a very, very safe product, and should never have to worry about bacteria growth and buildup on a wood cutting board.
When is it time to apply a mineral oil, a food grade mineral oil, to the cutting board?
For us, I condition our product with a, if I use the word tongue oil, it's a tongue-based oil that it's seed-based, and that's what we use to condition. And we do that to seal it. It makes it look great, and you can continue that with then, as you wash it, you know, the soap and water with on a cutting board will start leaching out the moisture out of the wood. When the wood looks dry, that's when you want to apply at least a mineral oil. Mineral oil, for the most part, that you buy at a drugstore is food grade, food safe, and there's no problem with that. You'd have to ingest quite a bit of it to create any bodily issue.
What about prepping the surface before applying the oil? Because I've seen where you rub the lemon juice in and then you drizzle the sea salt and then you let it sit and then you rinse it off and then you oil it. What do you think of that process?
It's excessive. I have never used that principle. We suggest lemon oil or lemon juice, mm-hmm. directly from the lemon. It's a citrus, obviously. As far as if you have stains, or say you're at the summertime and you put a can of soda and it's sweating and it creates a ring, the lemon juice will help bleach out those stains. Same thing with, like strawberries, anything that creates a natural stain in the wood. The salt, I've never heard of, but, that could be a thing. Mm-hmm. But from our perspective, because the wood is already naturally cleaning the wood itself, I never worry about bacteria, absolutely never. I'll cut, meat, I'll cut vegetables. Cleaning in the middle of that, and you can use soap and water on it. The key is keeping your board dry, so that it depending on the thickness of the wood, it doesn't warp or potentially crack by expanding and contracting. If the wood looks dry, that's when you want to apply your mineral oil. If it's a mineral oil with a cream, which would be a beeswax combination,
yes,
you're then getting the best of both worlds, because the mineral oil absorbs into the wood through the end grain, and so you get the moisturizing, and then the beeswax then puts a protective covering on it. And creates a more of a waterproof, you can see the water bead up on it. And you do that once a week, or, you know, after you've had the board a while and you've been washing it, drying it, you'll tend to see it look a little drier more often.
That's your cue.
That's your cue, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Rick Odey manufactures handcrafted wood kitchen products like cutting boards in Sturgeon Bay as we examine the life and times of our kitchen cutting boards. Still time for what you are most curious about with cutting boards, 800-642-1234. Call in with your questions. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We are hearing from a Door County-based cutting board and wood products business owner. Woodworker Rick Odey is with us, and still time to bring up your questions about an essential kitchen tool, that being your cutting boards. 800-642-1234. Email your questions to ideas@wpr.org. Let's bring in Dan in Paddock Lake. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Hey, I have a question for your guest there. Hey, I'm actually right in the middle of making a cutting board. I stopped when I heard the radio, what you guys are talking about. Rick, I think your name is. Is that it, Rick?
Yep.
Yeah. Hey, I'm making one of them 3D cube, three-dimensional cutting boards, and I have to make like the six panels, you know, make the sandwiches. You might be familiar with what I'm talking about. So I have to do four maple, one cherry, one walnut. So I made these panels like cutting boards. I made them eng grade, you know, cut them into strips, flipped them over, glued them up. And then when I go through this whole process of cutting and gluing and cutting and gluing to make this 3D, do you think I could get away with making my initial panels just being face grain? So I could just like glue up 3-5 foot wide boards and be a face grain panel instead of cutting it onto all these like 15 strips, flipping them over, gluing them up for my six panels. You know what I'm asking?
Dan, thank you.
Yes, I do know what you're asking. And personally, I have not made any 3D cutting boards. I think they're amazing. And I really appreciate the what goes into making them. I think it for woodworking, and in this particular case, there's no wrong answer, because you can take what you're using, the pattern, and experiment with it. And I, as far as if I understand it correctly, it wouldn't be a problem to do it on the face grain. And, there's nothing wrong with experimenting, because the result may be exactly what you want. It may be a little bit different, but the neat thing is that it's still a functional art. And that's ultimately what I do as a traditional, more traditional looking end grain product to some of the neat 3D boards. I'd almost have to be in your shop and we'd talk it through and we can visualize it, but there's no right or wrong answer. You're going to get a neat end product either way you do it. That's what I'd say. Go for it.
Dan, green light there. Get back to work on the cutting and gluing.
As soon as the show is over, I will. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much. So, Rick, turning back to picking out a cutting board, how do you ensure for the shopper or the home chef, how do you make sure that the cutting board is well made?
Well, ultimately you don't. I mean, I can guarantee it from my perspective if you're buying our product, but you ultimately don't know until you start using it and cleaning it and taking care of it. You know, and that's the biggest variable that a consumer is going to have. You know, I've been doing this for 22 years. The glues have changed. The process has changed a little bit. And, you know, those are things that are important, because the better the glues and oils get, the better the product stays together. You know, it's all about the preparation of the wood in the long run to determine, you know, how that board is going to, you know, stay together. Because once it leaves the store, the shop, and we ship it across country, you know, the wood has to adapt to the environment that wherever the home is. And we send a lot of product to each, you know, the East Coast and the West Coast, and it has to adapt.
So to the environment.
It acclimates to the environment and expands and contracts as the weather changes. So you ultimately can't, there's no way to tell.
Well, with that in mind, though, and as you mentioned, acclimation, how do you recommend storing a wooden cutting board?
Well, from our perspective, you know, they're functional art pieces, so we would hope that they stay on the counter, and because it is it's a statement piece that usually sits next to the, you know, your stovetop, and if not, as far as if you have to store based on just the limited counter space you have. You know, the bigger, thicker boards, like our standard boards, you know, they're almost 2 inches thick. So you can store them standing up. You can store them laying down. You know, there is no rhyme or reason. You know, the big thing now is to, like on an edge grain shaped board, is to put them on a wall, display them, put them on your back.
Yes, a little collage. Yes. Really quickly here, because we're just about out of time, Christina from Glenwood called in to ask, if you buy a high-quality board and maintain it well, how long will it last?
Oh, gosh. You know, we say 50-plus years, and frankly, I talk to people that have purchased a product, when I first started over 20 years ago, that they're going strong. And, a company that stands behind their board, if it's a great company, they'll take that board back, they'll resurface it, they'll make it look brand new so you can keep going another 20-plus years. So it just depends on how much character you want to show. And, it kind of shows where your cutting habits are on the board.
But and your cutlery through the ages. Rick, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having us.
Rick Odie co-owns Richard Rose Culinary and Cutting Boards, and more companies are based in Sturgeon Bay. And earlier we talked kitchen knives with Josh Donald. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. The Morning Show production team includes Courtney Everett, Trevor Hook, McKinsey Crummy, Joel Patnod, Royce Padeswa, and Joe Tarr. Our technical director is Maria Lopez. Keegan Kyle is interim executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Stay with us next for 1A here on the Ideas Network.